Welcome back, everyone. This is Kelly Mason and Leslie Carson, and you are listening to the Early Intervention Podcast. I hope you enjoyed our SNL spoof last month with Alicia. Don't worry, we are preparing for some other character work to leave everybody entertained. Okay, Leslie, tell me about today's podcast.
Yes. Today, episode 9, titled Stuttering and the Developing Child, is with our guest, Amy Cook. She's a pediatric speech-language pathologist, but before we bring Amy on, hey, Kelly, tell me something good.
Okay, today's Tell Me Something Good comes from a very special guest.
Hi, Andy Reid here, Johnson County Infant Toddler Services. I'd like to just thank you for all you do, your early intervention for kids with disabilities is second to none. I've seen it firsthand with my grandkids, and you're just much appreciated in all the great work that you do in this Kansas City area. We need you, and keep fighting the fight there. Thank you. Bye.
So pretty cool, huh?
Wow. I have to follow Andy Reid. Are you kidding me?
Did she not tell you that?
No.
It was a surprise for everybody. And I really love your reaction because this is our second take. Apparently, the first take, I did not have the volume on. And so Leslie and Amy were just looking at me like, yeah, that's really cool. We don't even know what you're talking about. But yeah, Amy, you've got to follow Andy Reid.
No pressure.
You got this. You got it. Well, let me introduce our guest today. We have the amazing and wonderful Amy Cook. And after receiving her master's degree from the University of Arizona, Amy began her career as a speech-language pathologist contracting with a private practice. Amy's worked in a variety of settings with clients of all ages, and she realized that her visits with the birth to three population were among her favorites. Amy became a passionate supporter of play-based early intervention service delivery model. With more than 20 years experience, she's recognized the importance of collaborating with caregivers and embedding therapeutic strategies into routines that can be targeted throughout the day. She identified childhood apraxia of speech, fluency disorders, cerebral visual impairment, and feeding challenges as her professional interests. She's licensed in both Kansas and Missouri and holds a certificate of clinical competence from ASHA. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you, guys.
Well, Amy, you sound really smart with this bio. I wish I could be you.
It depends on who you ask. My mom would say, for sure, I'm smart. My children would say, absolutely not. And my husband would say that I am a know-it-all. So I appreciate the compliment from you.
Speaking of your husband, really quick, Amy, I'm so sorry this is off topic, but can you tell this story about Taco Tuesday?
Yes. Okay. So when my kids were little, I used to work at a center-based program, and I would do visits for First Steps, the Missouri Infant Toddler Program, every Tuesday and Thursday evening. And I did this for many years. And we always had tacos on Tuesday and Sloppy Joes on Thursday because that's what he was really good at making. And every Tuesday and every Thursday for at least 3 years, he would text me and ask what he was supposed to make for dinner.
You gotta love him. Gotta love him.
Love it.
Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about stuttering. It really is a topic I don't know much about, so I'm excited to find out more.
You guys, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. I love that you invited me to be a guest on the Early Intervention Podcast and that I get to spend time this morning chatting with the two of you. I did want to give a disclaimer, though. This is my first time on a podcast, so I'm a little nervous, but I figured out the microphone, so I think we're off to a great, great start. My hope is that the listeners are going to learn something today and we have fun along the way.
Yeah, you're doing great. Okay, talk to us about stuttering. What is the prevalence of stuttering in the early childhood population?
Yeah, so we know that stuttering prevalence can vary with age. Approximately 5% of children are going to stutter for at least 6 months at some point in their childhood. But we do know that stuttering occurs more often in those children that are ages 2 to 5. Some studies have indicated that 10% of this population stutters. And we know that the prevalence of stuttering is even higher in children with developmental delays, ADHD, autism, as well as children with Down syndrome.
So Amy, why do some toddlers go through that developmental stutter? And at what age would you most likely see this?
Yeah, so developmental stuttering, we used to call it typical disfluency, occurs when a child is between the ages of 2 and 5. And the thought is that some children may stutter or have these moments of disfluent speech because of the rapid growth that they're experiencing in their language skills, as well as other developmental learning that's simultaneously taking place. So if we think about a child who's going to fall between the ages of 2 and 3, they're expanding their vocabulary, they're beginning to learn the grammatical concepts of their language, they're asking and answering questions, they're recalling past events as their memory improves, they're developing understanding of concepts, we see imaginative play emerge. And then if we think about their gross and fine motor skills, they're running, they're jumping, they're maneuvering stairs, they're learning to use their hands to open doors and feed themselves. They begin to dress themselves. It is a lot. They are learning a lot of skills for a young brain. And so because of this growth, especially in the area of language, it's quite possible that the child's going to stutter because their speech skills just can't keep up with what they want to say. And so this leads to a disruption with the flow of speech that can present in events like word repetitions, the use of filler words like or like. And we see that their disfluencies increase when they're excited, tired, or rushed. If you think about a 2-year-old, that's a lot of the time, right? That they're excited, tired, or rushed. So it is very, very common to see children stutter at this age.
Well, thinking about the kids that we work with, kind of, you know, the birth to three population, obviously, when they're talking, when would it not be a typical developmental stutter?
That's a great question, and one that a lot of people ask, and I think it's an important question. So because we are seeing kids in that birth to three range, it's quite possible for us to meet a child who is 2, 2.5, who is stuttering. And again, it can be really common for children this age to stutter. For most of them, it's a part of learning to speak. It's going to naturally improve without any assistance. But we do know that 20 to 25% of the children will continue and may need support. And so there's some factors that we can consider that help us determine if the child has childhood onset stuttering and not a developmental stutter. And so children who are more likely to have childhood onset of stuttering and not a developmental stutter, they're going to have a family history of stuttering. Their stuttering is going to have lasted longer than 6 months. It's quite possible that we'll see co-occurring speech or language problems or difficulties. We see that their disfluent events are increasing in frequency and now include muscle tightening. They also might demonstrate use of a secondary behavior. Now, a secondary behavior is a learned response that accompanies the stuttering behavior. So as the child is repeating words or sounds or phrases or prolonging sounds or blocking, they are developing a coping mechanism. So in an attempt to manage the anxiety or frustration they're feeling, they're going to blink their eyes. They might nod their head. They may tap their foot. They might clear their throat. And this is all an attempt to kind of get over that moment of disfluency. We also look at, is the stuttering affecting the child's ability to communicate? And is it causing anxiety, such as a fear of talking? They don't want to take part in a situation that requires speaking.
So really quick question, what is blocking?
So blocking is when I go to say the word and nothing emerges, no sound comes out. So it looks like I'm going to say something, but my word is just literally stuck. It won't come out.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Amy, what is the difference, or are there differences between boys and girls when it comes to either the childhood onset or the developmental stutter?
Yeah, there are differences between boys and girls. We typically see in preschoolers a ratio of 2 boys for every 1 girl who stutters. Girls tend to outgrow or recover without treatment, whereas boys are more likely to continue to stutter. In later childhood, what we see is that around 4 boys stutter for every girl. In families, we see that more fathers and brothers stutter than mothers and sisters. And so there's some interesting ideas on why there's gender differences in regards to stuttering. Are you guys interested? Do you want to maybe take a guess?
Yes.
Why is
so
that, Amy?
Some have suggested that it's due to those innate differences between the speech and language abilities between boys and girls. They also think that females may be more resistant to inheriting genetic factors that predispose someone to stuttering. and they have better recovery rates when they do stutter, possibly due to estrogen, which I think is interesting.
Huh.
They've even wondered if female brains have a greater capacity to just related to neuroplasticity, which just means that the female brain might be able to change, reorganize, form new connections better than the male brain. And then they also wonder if testosterone plays a part in it. So just really interesting. But again, like everything, more research is needed to kind of fully understand all of these links.
So what I'm hearing you say is that females are more superior.
Yes, completely.
I was Kelly, thinking the same thing.
Females will understand the pattern of Taco Tuesday and Sloppy Joe Thursdays much quicker than the male brain will.
I feel like I would get that within 1 week. So thinking about like assessments, when you're going out to, you know, there's a concern for stuttering and you go out to do an evaluation, an assessment, what kind of questions are you asking caregivers that help you determine whether or not the stutter is developmental or not?
Yeah. So during the evaluation, I want to ask about family history. I want to know if either parent knows if they had a family member who stuttered or previously stuttered, because we know that almost half of children who stutter have a family member who also stutters. That risk decreases if the family member outgrows the stuttering without intervention. I'm also going to ask how long the child's been stuttering. I'm looking to see if it's been present for at least 6 months, because that's concerning to me. I also ask about the disfluencies. Do they seem to be getting worse? Are they becoming more frequent? Have the type of disfluencies changed? Are the parents starting to see blocking and they previously didn't? Are there any situations that seem to make stuttering worse? What's really important is the child's reaction. So, what's the child do when they have these moments of disfluency? Do they seem bothered by it? Is it making them anxious? And then lastly, I'll check in with the parent to see what their attitude and level of concern is about the child's speech. You know, back in the day, we used to take a lot of stock in the severity rating. So we'd calculate how many times the child spoke and how many syllables they stuttered. Now, with the neurodiversity affirming movement, we're paying more attention to how it's affecting the child and the parents and the family. And we're trying to be supportive of speaking differences. So be more supportive of people who stutter and not saying, hey, you need to produce fluent speech. Really thinking about, hey, how is the stuttering affecting your life? We don't care about the severity. We care about how it's affecting you and your family.
Well, this kind of leads into the next question that I have, which is about continuing on that assessment route. We've all been there during assessment, especially with infants and toddlers. But if you go to an assessment, an evaluation, the child's not talking, you're not observing any speech during that time. You mentioned some of the other things that you do to get information. What is there anything else that maybe you ask about or parents provide for you during that time if you don't directly see or hear any language?
Yeah. So sometimes the kids do not make a peep when you're there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of my history with stuttering involved my son. He started to stutter when he was 2. It went away. It came back. It went away. And then it came back. And during this time, I was super scared and anxious. I didn't really know what to do. I knew I needed outside help, but I was having a really hard time determining my appropriate next steps because I was just overwhelmed. It was like I was frozen. And I think my emotions were interfering with my decision-making ability to how best to help him. So I decided to take him to an outpatient evaluation. And that little stinker who had been stuttering up a storm hardly spoke at all to the therapist and had one disfluency.
Of course, yes.
I actually found the copy of his evaluation the other day in our storage room in our file cabinet. And I chuckled because one of my kids, had scribbled all over it. And I remember they went through it period of time where they were scribbling on all kinds of important documents. They scribbled on my passport. They scribbled on my jury summons form, and they scribbled on the evaluation, the stuttering evaluation.
Sounds like they had really good fine motor. Of course, right?
But was it the same kid? Was it, I mean, or all of them?
Well, so Logan used to write his name on things that he scribbled on. He scribbled on a pair of boots one time of mine, these new expensive boots, and he wrote his name on them. So I would guess it would probably be Sawyer if I had to guess, but I don't know. Do you guys care if I read you the paragraph about
what read it.
Okay. Yeah. So she writes that only one disfluent event was observed today when Sawyer was trying to tell his mother something about an animal while playing with a toy barn. He produced several repetitions of before saying giddy up. Mother believed that his initial intent was not to say giddy up and that he revised what he was actually trying to say. Sawyer was most verbal when talking to his mother and at times when playing on his own. Expressive language decreased significantly when the clinician attempted to interact with him. When interacting with the clinician, Sawyer was most verbal during formal test procedures, but even then did not expand utterances beyond responses to test stimuli. He provided some information about his brother in short 1 to 2 word utterances. Typically, the clinician had to give him a choice of possible verbal responses. So there we go, right? When I kind of reflect back about that paragraph, I wonder if he was only producing those 1 and 2 word utterances because he was trying to speak fluently. And because at that point, he'd started to tell us, I can't talk, or he'd quit speaking and start to cry. And so I think he'd figured out that he was pretty fluent with shorter utterances. And so that's what he did in this unfamiliar environment. So if your little one is going to do what my son did and avoid speaking at the evaluation, I'm going to rely on the parents to give me lots of great information. Because we live in a world where everyone has a cell phone, I might ask to see if they have a video of their child speaking. In fact, I might plant that seed when I schedule the evaluation. I might ask about the child's personality. Are they a little bit more reserved? Do the parents think they might be super shy when I'm there? If so, I might ask the family to have a video prepared so I can see if the child is nervous while I'm there. Sometimes I might suggest that I kind of sit off in the back like a strange weirdo, right? And the parent can play with the child and I pretend I'm not listening, but I really am. If after all of this, I still feel like I don't have enough information, I'm going to suggest that we extend the evaluation and I come out a second time.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Are there any other signs a toddler might demonstrate that aid you in the assessment that you haven't mentioned?
Yeah. So if they're going to speak at that evaluation, their speech sample is going to definitely help me out. The type of disfluencies, whether they exhibit any tension when they speak, if there are any secondary behaviors that the child uses. And that's, again, when they're maybe blinking their eyes or maybe they're tapping their foot or they're turning their head as they're trying to get over that disfluent moment.
Well, I feel like you have addressed the difference between like a developmental stutter and the childhood onset, but in case there's anything else you wanted to share about those differences between the developmental stutter and a fluency disorder.
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question, right? I mean, we don't want to ring the alarm bells and overreact if the child has a developmental stutter. However, what if it continues and it's not a developmental stutter? So luckily, there are those ways that we can differentiate typical disfluency from stuttering. Children who are stuttering are going to repeat sounds or words more than just a few times. They're going to present with that tension in their face. Their pitch might rise as they stutter. They look like they're trying to say something, but no sound emerges. We see those secondary behaviors, and the child might become aware of it. So the stuttering is starting to interfere with their life. They may avoid speaking or participating in social interactions. And if this is happening, then children, I feel, need support from a speech-language pathologist if the family's interested. And of course, we want to end the stigma surrounding stuttering, and we want to be accepting of all types of speakers. However, the family might want to avoid any potential social consequences to stuttering or any issues that the child might have with self-confidence. So in my case, my emotions were deeply affected, and I'm sure I was not at my best. And I'm sure it was hard for me to have positive interactions with my children. I knew I didn't do anything to cause Sawyer stuttering, but I also feel like I wasn't necessarily helping him either. And so, did you guys hear that?
That sounds like there's somebody that's joining our call.
Is it Andy Reid?
I think it is. He's here live.
Surprise.
No, I think it's gone now.
Okay. So, of course, we would have accepted any version of Sawyer. However, he was shutting down. So we had a choice. We could accept his stuttering as part of him
and lose so many of the aspects of his personality, or we could work to reduce his stuttering so that he felt comfortable interacting with his world. And we chose to reduce his stuttering and focus on communication and interaction. Parents can always reach out to their pediatrician to discuss what early intervention programs are available, hospital-based programs, or local speech-language pathologists. That's what we did. That's where we started, was with our pediatrician.
Tell us about Sawyer now.
Sawyer's doing great now. He did have speech therapy for several months. He did recover, and he's living his best life in Milwaukee, going to school.
College.
Yes.
I think it's always important to, you know, Amy, you mentioned your emotions. Like when it's your child, it's, you know, hard.
Yeah.
It was hard. I was just frozen. I mean, I had been a speech path for, gosh, over 10 years at that point, and I just had no clue what to do until someone told me step by step what I needed to do.
So what are some disfluencies that are seen in toddlers?
Yeah, so examples of those disfluencies that are consistent with developmental stuttering, those are going to be hesitations between words. We might hear the child say, "Can I have a cookie?" They're going to use interjections such as, so... like, we might see them revise what they're saying. So if they're looking outside, they may tell their mom, "Look, I see ya. There's a car." So I was starting to say, "Look, I see ya," and then I had a hard time retrieving that word. I'm going to switch it and say, "There's a car." And then we'll see repetition of phrases. I want to play.
Can you share with us a little bit about motor planning, what it is, and when should there be intervention for stuttering versus just that motor planning or letting the brain develop and eventually get to the motor planning piece?
Yeah. Motor planning is how we sequence and coordinate muscle movements needed for the production of speech. In stuttering, there's going to be that breakdown in the process of creating and executing the speech motor plan. Interestingly enough, research has determined that there is evidence showing atypical brain activity in the regions responsible for speech motor planning and execution during instances of stuttering. And so these issues lead to disfluent speech, such as those repetitions, those prolongations, those blocks. And while we don't want to overreact to a developmentally appropriate stutter, a wait and see approach can be harmful. And so we're going to use those risk factors to help guide our decision. Do we start intervention? Do we monitor the child? Do we give the parent guidelines or suggestions on how to respond to the instances of stuttering? My concern with just letting the brain develop is what happens if the child never gets the motor plan? Then we've lost that precious time. And we know that preschoolers respond really, really well to intervention for stuttering. And so we can help them improve that motor plan for fluent speech production and prevent them from having any negative social experiences because of stuttering.
Is there new research on how to approach stuttering in early intervention? I know you have already mentioned a little bit about like the neurodiversity and, you know, following the parents' lead with that. But what does research show about how to approach it?
Yeah, so the last several years, there's been studies that have compared different treatment programs or approaches that can be used with preschool children. And what they found is that the treatment approaches all show similar success rates. They were all found to be helpful in reducing instances of stuttering for some children. No treatment worked for everyone, but they did find that 90 to 95% of young children who stutter will recover on their own through natural recovery or with the help of treatment. So 75 to 80% recover on their own were able to help those additional children with intervention. In one study, more families dropped out when parents were asked to implement an indirect approach, and fewer families dropped out when they were using a more directive approach. And so I think these findings are really encouraging for therapists, because what we can do is include the family in on what approach we're going to do. We can give them all of the information, and then they can tell us what they feel like would work best for their child as well as their family and their life, basically. And therapy really can be individualized for the child and the family. Another study that I want to talk about looks at the combination of factors that we use when determining if a child's going to persist in stuttering. And so the authors of the study acknowledge that nothing can tell us with 100% certainty
whether a child's stuttering will continue, but they feel like using multiple measures can give us more clarity. And so the children in the study were between the ages of 3 and 5. The researchers found that family history and stuttering severity were the most important pieces of information. So children with no family history and mild stuttering severity are likely to recover. Children with a family history of persistent stuttering or recovered stuttering with moderate or severe stuttering themselves are likely to develop chronic stuttering. And then the children who are kind of falling in the middle, what the researchers used was non-word repetition skills. And they found that a child with no family history, an average severity rating, and a below average non-word repetition is more likely to persist in stuttering than a child with an above average non-word repetition. And I think that addresses the importance of some of our children who are at risk are the ones that have those co-occurring speech and language delays or difficulties.
When you've talked a little bit about including the family in the approach and sharing that information with them, what are some of the therapy strategies or approaches that you have used when working with children and families?
Yeah, so there's two different types of therapy methods, the indirect and the direct. The indirect is going to be when we modify or change the child's environment and speaking style of the parents to hopefully facilitate fluency. It's not going to involve direct instruction or modification of the child's speech. So examples might be having the parent make comments or narrate instead of asking questions. Use a slower rate of speech with pausing. We'll teach the family to be attentive listeners by maintaining eye contact, waiting for their child to finish their thought without interrupting the child. We want the family to focus on the message rather than how they say it. We also want to see if the family can identify anything that makes the child's disfluencies increase. And if so, we'd ask them to avoid that. Type of intervention can be appropriate for preschoolers unaware that they're stuttering. But I always stress with the families that we're adapting the environment and their speaking style, but in no way did they cause the stuttering. We know that the genetics and neurology are the cause of stuttering with environment influencing severity and persistence. But I just want to make sure that if we go down that indirect route, the parent knows that they aren't to blame.
Tell us a little bit about that direct route.
Yeah. So
direct intervention.
Yeah. Direct therapy is when we are directly addressing and modifying the child's speech. And so the primary focus is the motor aspects of speech. So this may include fluency shaping, like easy onset, stretchy speech, where we're going to prolong the speech sounds, or we're going to teach the child to make light contact to avoid tension. Now, I think that's a little bit hard to do with 2-year-olds and 2.5-year-olds. I think that they are too young to try some of that. And so I feel like one program that I like to use is the Lidcombe program. And this is an evidence-based treatment approach that the parent's going to deliver. It's meant for children under the age of 6. The parent provides feedback about the child's speech. It uses positive reinforcement for fluent speech and then gentle requests for attempts at correcting stuttered speech at a ratio of 5-1. So in other words, the parent's going to acknowledge 5 fluent utterances for every stuttered utterance. And so with the Lidcombe, the SLP is guiding the parent who the parent has daily practice sessions with the child. And then the parent also learns to rate the child's stuttering from 0 to 10. So meaning that 0 is the child did not stutter, 10 means it was severe stuttering. And so I'll use that program. And then I like to begin to reduce that stigma around stuttering. So I'll talk to the child and the parent that everybody has bumps when they talk. I'll point out my disfluencies as I'm speaking. And I remind them that bumps are okay.
That's a great reminder. Mm-hmm. And I know you've already addressed a little bit of this, but when you're talking with parents, I'm sure there's lots of questions about how do I handle this in the home or with family members? How do you suggest that they do that within the home or in the community?
Yeah, those are great questions. So I think we encourage parents to support that calm environment. And we want parents to model slow and relaxed speech by using a slower speaking rate while pausing. We just want the child to realize that the exchange isn't as hurried or rushed, because we know that when the child feels that, their disfluencies may increase. We want parents to be active listeners. We want them to avoid interrupting or trying to help their child. We'll ask parents to refrain from telling them to slow down or take a breath. One thing that I like to do, if it's a particularly difficult day for the child in terms of their disfluencies where they're just stuttering more, is let's limit our open-ended questions. So instead of asking the child, what did you do at daycare today? I might say, did you play outside? Was it fun? Did you go down the slide? Which seems counterintuitive, because usually we're told, hey, ask all these open-ended questions because that's going to facilitate their language skills. Well, at this point, we don't want to facilitate their language. We want to help with their speech fluency. And so we're going to ask those closed-ended questions to encourage the child to answer us in one or two word responses. And that way, we're increasing the likelihood that they're going to be fluent.
So sort of like when the speech pathologist was asking Sawyer about his brother and giving him choices.
Yep, exactly. Yes, that was twofold, right? She's trying to get him to talk and she's trying to set him up for fluency.
Yeah.
Guys, and I've also found that when we've determined that a child's stuttering isn't just that typical disfluency, it isn't a developmental stutter, parents are ready to hit the ground running. They want a pretty specific plan. And so that's why a lot of them like the Lidcombe, because it tells you exactly what to do. And when I think about the research and the families that were dropping out of those studies where it was an indirect route, I think that's what was happening. That the plan, the indirect route sometimes feels like it's not as specific, that you're asking the family just throughout their day to make these modifications, but they don't have that set specific how-to plan that they do with like the Lidcombe.
Yeah. And are you saying Lidcombe? Like
yes.
Lid?
Yes.
Comb I comb my hair with?
Yep. C-O-M-B-E. Yeah.
Okay.
AB, do you, or what are some resources that you might recommend to caregivers? And that might even be, or may not be, social media, but we know that's present. And then what are some other recommendations you might have for therapists so they could build their knowledge and being able to support a family or a child who stutters?
Yeah, so I love the Stuttering Foundation. I think that they have a really nice, informative, helpful website. They also have a magazine that they send out to individuals on their distribution list. And in fact, I just received one a couple weeks ago, and I wondered if it was the universe telling me that I needed to share some things. Because in this particular installment of their magazine, it includes letters from kids who stutter. And these kids are a hoot. They're funny, they're honest, they're resilient, they're logical, they're overall just wonderful. So I think sometimes as parents, our kids can help us and show us that they're resilient and that they can work through hard things. I always tell my kids, you can do hard things. And then they remind me that I can do hard things too. So I'm going to read a couple, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Love it.
Okay, so I do have my readers on, and so we'll see if my old lady eyes cooperate. So this first little one, she says that she's 9 years old, and she's from Kentucky. She writes, I am in fourth grade. I started to stutter when I was 4 years old. I started speech in third grade. My speech therapist taught me easy onset, slow rate, light contact, pausing, and phrasing, and stretchy speech. I love to stutter because it shows my true self. And when I tell people about it, it makes me proud. Also, some famous people who stutter are Kendrick Lamar and Ed Sheeran. I'm currently doing drama club and basketball. When I grow up, I want to be a doctor. I also like to draw. I hate when kids burp and fart. I had to include that one because I thought, what are the odds? Do you think Leslie and Kelly would ever in a million years think that fart and burp would come up in the podcast about stuttering?
Maybe. You never know. You just never know. But I love that story. That is so sweet.
I have like a couple more. Do you guys care?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Love it.
So this next one, he writes, I'm in second grade and I am 7 years old. I love my family. I have a twin brother, mom, mommy, two dogs, and a cat. I live in Wisconsin, but I'm going to Montana soon. I'm excited to move and I like getting to drive through many states. My favorite thing in the world is Baby Yoda. He's so cute. I love Baby Yoda's Crocs, his bed, stuffies, shirts, backpack, glasses, and pajamas. I also like to watch Star Wars movies. Sometimes I stutter, which sounds like bumpy speech. This can make me feel sad. To help me, I use strategies from my speech toolkit. I use stretchy speech, easy onset, keeping my voice on, and pausing. The strategies make me feel happy. My advice to other people is to stay calm, even if you stutter. It's okay. Oh, and I've got just one more, if you guys will bear with
me. I'm so glad. I asked you if you were going to tell jokes. These stories are better. I love it.
And I get to say fart and burp and, you know, I think we're all 14-year-old boys at heart. Okay, this one, he's entitled Believe in Yourself. Hi, my name is Remington. I am 10 years old. I have two sisters, 8 girl cousins, and a boy cousin. I like Nerf guns and the movie Fast and Furious. I also like the game American Marksman, hunting and fishing. One time when my dad and I went ice fishing, we set up tip-ups. And I caught a big largemouth bass. He was 23 inches and 5 to 6 pounds. I stutter a lot, but it's fine that I stutter because stuttering is not bad. Even though I stutter, it doesn't mean I'm different. It just means I say sounds over and over again like a repetition. That's how I stutter. So don't be shy to talk. In speech, I learned that pausing helps me to not stutter as much. So what are your strategies to help you not stutter? I go to my speech therapist who helps me to learn about stuttering. In her classroom, I learned that girls stutter more than boys, and you might stutter your whole life. Don't worry if you stutter. You'll be fine. Just remember how you talk doesn't change your abilities in your heart.
That is so sweet. I love that. These are great kids.
Yes. I know.
Love these stories.
Love it. So you had asked about resources. So I'm going to get back on that track since I had kind of a squirrel moment there. Okay. Other great ones are the National Stuttering Association. They've got educational materials, family programs, support groups. Stuttering Therapy Resources has handouts and a blog posts for families that are really helpful. There's Stuttering Treatment and Research Society. There are podcasts like this one, plug for Early Intervention Podcast. And there are lots of online support groups. For therapists, ASHA has a toolkit as well as a practice portal. And they've got these evidence maps that are really cool. They offer summaries of available research. So, definitely therapists take part in that. That's why you're paying those ASHA dues. Some therapists have also liked the Early Childhood Stuttering Therapy Practical Guide. That is a manual that's available in print as well as digital format. So yeah, those are all resources that I would suggest for families and therapists.
Those are so great. Amy, we want to thank you. You are amazing on the podcast. And we always want to leave our listeners with one tip or strategy. What would that be? What would you want to leave them with?
That is a great question. Let me see. I think looking back, if I was putting myself in the shoes of someone with a child that is 2 to 3 years of age, I'd encourage parents to set aside time to give their child or children a few minutes of interrupted attention each day, especially in this busy world that we live in. It's important for moms. It's important for kids. It strengthens our bond with our children. It builds confidence. It's going to reduce attention-seeking behaviors. It helps our toddlers feel loved and secure. It improves their focus, and it really supports the development of their language and social emotional skills because we've got this beautiful, responsive, two-way interaction. And I always encourage families to have the screens away during this time. So just have a toy with your child, have a book, go for a walk, do something completely uninterrupted, so you can focus wholly on your child and enjoy your sweet little one.
Because it goes by so fast.
It really does.
Yeah. It does. That's a great reminder and a great strategy for us to all be present and take a few moments to pause. So
I think if I could go back, I would increase the amount of time that I did that. Because you're right, Kelly and Leslie, it goes by so fast.
I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, as part of our podcast, we want to highlight someone or something as it relates to early intervention by giving them a shout out. And today, our shout out goes to audiologists. October is Audiology Awareness Month, and we want to highlight the importance of hearing health and raise awareness on hearing disorders. So thank you, audiologists. And that wraps up our episode of the Early Intervention Podcast. Amy, thank you so much for sharing all this wonderful information and the stories. It was lovely to have you on. We have a very special December podcast coming out, so make sure you tune in on December 1st. And you can listen to the Early Intervention Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Music.
Please email us at earlyinterventionpodcast@gmail.com if there are any topics that come to mind or you want to be a featured guest. I even just got an email about something I think we're going to be using for Tell Me Something Good in the future. So that was great. We want to thank Friends of Fit Toddler Services for their support with this podcast. Friends of a Fit Toddler Services, or FITS, develops, maintains, and funds additional services and programs for children served by Infant Toddler Services of Kansas, serving Johnson County. They are funded through private donations, fundraising events such as the annual Fall Ball Gala, which is coming up on November 8th. There will be some merch there that maybe Andy Reid has signed, possibly. So you can learn more about their work by visiting our website, itsjc.org. And it's time to say goodbye.
Until next time.
Bye,
Thank you,
Amy.
Guys. Bye.